Good morning. My name is Renee Deschard. I am the Prairie Fire Newsletter editor, and I serve on the program, communications, and remodeling committees. And I have a 3-month-old and a toddler. Prairie aspires to be both open-hearted and open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, family structure, age, or abilities. Later in the service, we will invite visitors and guests and returning friends to introduce yourselves so that we might get to know you better. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services. They are presented either by a Prairie member or, in this case, a member of the wider community. So next week, we're at Sauk City. We do a joint service with them once a year in the summer. So don't come here. Don't go there. Don't go to Oak Park, because we won't be any of those places. You have to go to Sauk City. Also, RE has kind of field trips, so they're going to be doing Wingra boating. So if you're interested, if you want to do something different, you can do the boating, or you can go to Sauk City. We have options. And then starting on August 4th, for the rest of the summer, fall, and through December, we're going to be at Oak Park Place, Nakoma, because there's actually one on the east, far east side. So we were going to be there. They have a nice, large room. I'm fairly sure it's air-conditioned. They have a nice grand piano there. So it's going to be really nice, and that should be lots of space and everything. So we hope to see you in the next few weeks. Our opening words is A Protest and a Party by Hannah Roberts Villanueva. People sometimes ask, is Pride a protest or a party? And the answer is, of course, yes. And why not? Why not rejoice as we resist, dance as we demand change, celebrate as we create community that delights in all of who we are? So bring all of that with you this morning. Bring your policy demands, bring your glitter, bring your Supreme Court broken heart, bring your rainbow socks, bring the emptiness you feel for our siblings gone too soon. Bring your Gloria Estefan remix. Bring your tender hope for change. Bring your most garish eyeshadow. Bring your spirit tattered and battered by a world that seems insistent on choosing fear and hate. Gather up all these things and bring them here to a place where we don't have to shoulder these burdens or celebrate these joys alone. Come, let us worship together. We light this flame to renew our commitment that no one shall ever again suffer for the right to love. We light this flame to celebrate our kaleidoscope of diversity, working, loving, and living on the side of love. For this, we light this flame. This is by Linda Lee Franson. So, for our presentation, we have Dick Wagner. Dick Wagner is first out county board member in Wisconsin in 1980. He was co-chair of Governor Anthony Earle's Council on Lesbian and Gay Issues in 1983 and has researched and written on LGBT history for the last several decades. This June, the first of 2-volume series on Wisconsin's gay history, We've Been Here All Along, will be published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. So we welcome Mr. Dick Wagner.
It actually has been published. Hard copies are available. So right. When I sent that, it was not quite yet out, but it is out. So, and basically, I'm here because of the book and the research and the writing that I've been doing on gay history. And I'm not actually talking about the history of Pride celebrations in Madison. There's a wonderful article in Our Lives magazine, if you ever pick that up, that does actually cover those things very comprehensively by Scott Seyfert. But I want to talk about Pride, which for me has become an affirmation of my own humanity as one created in the image of God. And as an historian, I came to Wisconsin to study at the University of Wisconsin in the American History Department. I find some of that affirmation in history and the research that I've done. And so by presenting it in the book, and this is the first of 2 volumes, I try and enunciate that. And one of the things that I was reflecting on as I was trying to put these remarks together was that when I came out in the 1980s, one of the reactions I got from people was sort of like they were trying to comfort me as if there had been a death in my family. And, you know, that didn't really catch the right sense of it for me, but I appreciated their sense of wanting to try and offer some comfort. But it didn't really say, oh, it's something to be proud of. It was something to be, oh, lifted up because you had done this, you know, thing which might be wounding. So when I saw your opening hymn and the line, give me strength through stress and strife, part of that is the history of how LGBTQ people have dealt with the issue of dealing with their humanity and the pride in that. So part of what I want to talk about is some of that history. And there's sort of views of sort of the glass half full or the glass half empty kind of thing. If you think the glass is half empty, you think of the periods of homophobia that have been so strong. And for anybody raised in my generation, we were all raised heterosexual. So we were had this presumption internally that was in contradiction to our own identities as we began to discover them. But historically, and I'm an historian, so I'm going to take you through history, but bear with me. There was the period when it was sinful. And then there was the criminality. Then there was the sickness or medicalization. And then finally, in a modern world, there was a real crisis with AIDS. So considering the sinfulness, there was a poem done by Joseph P. Zanzoni, who was a public health practitioner. And in it he says, it was Ash Wednesday, and I was immune to ashes. Musing an image of paradise, a wayside wedding, denial, filing past, an immature passion. Gaining relief, I believe I was dead. So the sickness of sin in colonial times is one of those internalized homophobia that lingers in society and sometimes in individuals. The actual crime against nature was the Tudor law about sodomy. And in the Wisconsin Territory, once we became a territory separate from Michigan in 1836, the Wisconsin Territorial Legislature upped the penalty for sodomy from 3 years in prison to 5 years because the Michigan law hadn't been strong enough. In doing my research, I also uncovered the story of Richard Kilmer. And he's one of those people who got into ancestry, as some people do. And he found out he had a great-great-great-great-great-something grandfather who was hanged for sodomy in colonial New York. And so that was the reality of sort of the sin. And that got incorporated, as I said, into the law, which was brought from Tudor England over and became American law for so long. And then the Madison police reports gave me another revelation in that when I looked at the Madison police reports from the pre-World War I and into the pre-World War II period, they listed major crimes, and they had murder and sodomy right up there as major crimes, and so the sense of how evil it was. In the 1930s, there was an amazing researcher at the University of Wisconsin. He was John Gillam. He was a sociologist, and he went and studied the prisoners in Waupun. He had various theories about the origin of crime. But he studied all those who were there for sodomy, which was a group of about 20. And he had, when the men were literate, write their own sort of stories. And so for me, it was really remarkable to find these voices from the 1930s of gay men actually talking about themselves. And one of them was a gentleman by the name of Andrew Jastrach, good Middle European name here. He talked about being in Waupun. I've here learned the valuable and only lesson of charity. I've learned here to hate wrong of every shape and manner. I've also learned never to condemn anybody because I could never qualify to throw the first stone. Neither could any man on God's earth. So a sense that you could learn something, even in this period. In this same period, there's a remarkable story of two women in Milwaukee, Charlotte Partridge and Miriam Frink. They met at Milwaukee Downer College. Women's colleges were known breeders for domestic friendships, as they were often called back in those days. These two women went on to found the Layton School for the Arts, which became a very important Milwaukee institution. They broke some barriers in that they had the first sort of nude life models in their art school. They took a trip out west, and Miriam packed a pistol just to be clear for those Western times. And they were very involved in the New Deal art programs as well. Going away from the 30s then, in the World War II period, you began to have the medicalization, where psychiatrists, which had become popular, sort of with Freud being popularized in the 20s, sort of talked about homosexuality as an illness. And so in World War II, the Army was trying to screen out gays and lesbians from serving. They failed miserably, as tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of gays and lesbians actually served in the armed forces, because they were patriots in the fight against fascism like many other people. Bob Neill and Edgar Hellam, who had opened Pendarvis in the 1930s in Mineral Point, closed it and went to serve at Truax Army Air Force Base in their food service operation. Betty Siebenthal and Mary Locke, who were from Mount Horeb, but had actually met in New York, they went and worked in a munition factory. And later, Betty Siebenthal, who was a writer who wrote mysteries under men's pseudonyms because they could get published that way for her, also wrote a series of poems in a book, Acquainted with Chants of Bobcats, in which she has a series which I believe are dedicated to her partner, Mary Locke. Wally Jordan, who was from Rhinelander, created a whole correspondence network of other gay pen pals that he had created during the war. And he had a vision of a better life after the war, as so many did. And he says in one of his letters to Jim Kepner, an early gay activist on the West Coast, "My cousin joined the Army to fight and die if necessary for our free country, but is fighting more for the freedom of the middle sex than anything else. His idea is that if we lose the war, the middle sex will be lost too, along with everything else." There was a sense that they had a chance here in America that maybe things could be better. At Truax, the Army Air Force Base here in Madison, another professor from the university, E.L. Servinghouse, wanted to do some research. He had an endocrine theory on the origins of homosexuality. And so there were 21 gay men who had been identified out of Truax. And he took urine samples from these men and compared it with urine samples from men who he presumed were not homosexual. But he also had them write their own stories. And it's interesting in discovering this that there is a whole theory of emancipatory science whereby gays and lesbians participating in these studies tried to shift the narrative away from criminality and sickness by presenting their own lies, by getting their own words out there. And so they did participate in these studies, and even though often their comments were filtered, they come through. And that's particularly true in this Truax study that was done in 1945. The authors noted that the subjects had apparently participated without conflict in a wide variety of homosexual practices. The homosexual stories were remarkably similar. The homosexual subjects would probably be termed overt homosexuals. The doctors accepted that the cases would be considered extremely questionable from the standpoint of profiting from any therapy. In fact, therapy was not requested or desired by any of them, which clearly shows they themselves at that point had rejected the sickness label that was trying to be applied to them. And the researchers themselves also noted that while they expressed difficulty because of the situation of living in such close quarters with other soldiers, in none of these cases was there a true neurotic type of conflict over homosexuality as such. So that in this case, the doctors, this the one from the university, the other was from the base, concluded the same thing that the men themselves had concluded, that they weren't sick. Now, following World War II, this hope for a better world, actually a convention of homosexuals that Wally Jordan had envisioned, didn't come about. Instead, we had witch hunts. We had McCarthyism. And most people are familiar with the Red Scare that McCarthy generated, but most people aren't aware of the Lavender Scare, which was coterminous with it, in which McCarthy himself and many others persecuted both communists and queers. Research by gay scholars has actually shown that there were more gays discharged from the federal government than there were communists. They were easier to find because they were on police lists of criminals, whereas the communists, they weren't stepping forward. So it's forgotten today, and when you hear about McCarthyism, you never hear about the double persecution of both gays and queers during that time. But some resisted. One of those people who was fighting back was Lorraine Hansberry, a young African-American who became a famous dramatist. She was here at the university. She led the Young Progressives, of Wisconsin on campus, fighting against this kind of post-war hysteria. She would later send letters to The Ladder, which was the lesbian publication by the Daughters of Bilitis, and others from Wisconsin would also join in writing to The Ladder. One woman from Motson, and also Donna Utke from Milwaukee, who became an early incorporator of the Gay People's Union in Milwaukee, the first gay organization over there. Also at that time, during this Lavender Purge and McCarthyism, there was on campus a gay purge of students. The Dean of Men rounded up names of homosexuals, forced people to name names of other homosexuals, and compiled a list of a couple hundred of gay men on campus. Now, this wasn't done about women students, this was just men students. Part of the reason, perhaps, was that the Dean of Women was Martha Peterson, who was herself a lesbian and had no interest in cracking down on lesbians on campus. She and her partner, Dr. Maxine Bennett, were actually introduced by the university president, E.B. Fred. And his reasoning was, well, Martha was from Kansas and Max was from Nebraska, so they were neighbors and they ought to get to know each other, you know. Who knows, the president of the university could form partnerships. But nevertheless, during this period, gays did try to lead their own lives. I particularly am taken by a group of gay men who were focused on Jennifer Street in a house that I happen to live in. And so this house has almost a century of gay life in it at this point. But they got written up by one of the members who was a journalist from Rock County. And he said, the group, deeply concerned over the apparent inability of modern man to live a gracious, refined, and hospitable way of life in the press of unstable times. He further noted, these young men are attempting in a modest way to recreate a friendly, leisurely manner of living, and that it was notable and unusual. He further went on, among the group, you will find representatives in the field of theater, ballet, art, music, politics, literature, horticulture, and agriculture, who may converse in French or Spanish to increase the fluency of their acquired tongues. They were described as enjoying Café Diablo, a sweetened coffee with flaming brandy and whipped cream, which was not exactly a drink in mid-America then. And even though all the participants were men of very modest income, their homes displayed refined and impeccable taste. Some men preferred modern decor, reflecting of their residing in the land of Frank Lloyd Wright. Some arranged their homes as showplaces of antiques, and some bolder spirits combine period pieces with the ability of interior decorators. A little clue there about decorators. You know, they had a reputation. On the subject of friendship, they are equally adamant. Some had at-home gatherings on Sundays when friends dropped in, took off their shoes, raided the icebox, discussed aesthetics, and had enlightened conversation. Whenever a light is burning in any of these homes, the author writes, it is like a beacon of hospitality for owners who have endeavored to make their firesides a haven for unexpected guests. These Sunday at homes proved a counterpoint to the Sunday family dinners of the straight world, showing that gays were indeed building networks of support at this time. One of the Madison couples who sort of was later slightly connected with this group was Bob Lockhart and Clarence Cameron, and they observed part of the spontaneity was because you didn't know when the police were going to come. You had to live a life that figured. And one of them observed, Bob Lockhart, goodness sakes, I should have had a little education about this. And that's the other big theme that I try and deal with, is the total ignorance about gay and lesbian life because of cultural suppression that was going on. To me, I find pride in this history and that it's important that it not be erased and that we understand that even before Stonewall, there were many people who figured out how to live their lives, how to affirm their identity, and how to find support. So, as I mentioned, one of the other things that's coming up in the second volume is the crisis of AIDS and how it gets dealt with in this state. One of the things that occurred during the AIDS crisis in Wisconsin was there was a publication put out as a fundraiser for the Milwaukee AIDS Project called Heart Pieces. And it was gay and lesbians who were writing poems as a fundraiser for the early AIDS effort over there in Milwaukee. And one of them, a D.A. Leonard, wrote this poem. I am, and I denied who I am, and God cried. A wife and two innocent children, and God cried.
Those days are my past, and God cried. And then the discovery, and God cried. For I loved a man, and he loved me, and God cried for joy. At first, the denial and guilt, and God cried. Those days are my past, and God cried. No more, no more closet, and God cried. I'm real, I'm out, and God cried out for joy. Thank you very much for inviting me here today. Rarely, in part, women's sexuality was been discounted in male-dominated society of the days. I'm sorry, but it was often true. And actually, the laws that came over from England, they never criminalized lesbian sex because they were afraid to try and present such a law to Queen Victoria and explain it to her. And so the English law that we got didn't have the same bias against lesbianism as it did against male homosexuality. The Madison police reports do have one incident where the police chief says, oh, we had an unusual case and that two women were arrested for sodomy. Like, you know, one, he was startled by it, and that, you know, he had to mention it in his annual report because it was so unusual. One got sent to Cheetah, and the other got sent back to her home community. So there was some, but not as much against women. And in fact, the technical criminal law on sodomy, according to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, had to include a male organ, so therefore lesbians weren't really covered in that case. So. Unclear in some ways. Part of it stems, I think, from medieval times and what happens with sexuality during that period. Actually, in the native tradition, the two-spirited tradition, they had sort of a way of treating non-conforming gender identity, and that included tribes in Wisconsin like the Chippewa and the Ho-Chunk. Nancy Laurie, a scholar at the Milwaukee Public Museum, did a study in the 1940s about the Ho-Chunk tribe and what she called the Bradash tradition. It was a word from the French, which the French had first observed this in their interaction with American, North American Native peoples. So by the time Nancy was studying it in the 1940s, they had assumed enough Western culture that they thought this was a bad thing, even though traditions sort of lingered that it had been special people chosen by this moon quest, and that they had gone to this tradition of the two-spirited. So, Boswell and some other scholars have looked at sort of the origins of it. You know, it gets, with the policing of sexuality, which becomes much more common in the medieval ages than it does later, you get celibacy is imposed in the 12th century on seriously. And you get all these confessionals which talk about how you should treat sins and things like that in the church and things. I understand the impulse that you're talking about. And in early gay organizations, some, and they still continue the name, the Human Rights Campaign, was that they avoided lesbian or gay names initially to try and get a little cover. When we created the New Harvest Foundation board here in the mid-80s, 1980s, we had what we called OSs, or ostensible straights, on the board to try and give cover as well to people who wouldn't give to a gay foundation, but they might give to a foundation that had sort of mixed cover. But pride parades aren't going to change. The pride parades originate with the first anniversary of Stonewall, and they began in the village and they marked up to Central Park. You know, you wouldn't ask the Cinco de Mayo people to make theirs a celebration of everybody, nor the Juneteenth celebration to be a celebration of everybody. A community has its own celebrations, and it's going to remain one. Now, that doesn't mean that, like, when I was an out gay man on the county board, I couldn't fight for lots of other things, like public safety and social services, as well as a gay rights ordinance and other things that were important to my community. And so, you have to understand that that identity is one aspect of your humanity, but it's an important one. And it's been denied so long that the sense of pride in it is something that breaks loose, and that, particularly in my generation, a lot of gay men have that internalized homophobia, and ways to discard it are still important to them, that they have. Even though many of us don't go write parades anymore. Still, some still do, and I usually do. But there's also stories about books called Two Teenagers and Ten, which is about how young lesbian and gay people find their own sense of willingness to come out and say what their identity is. And one of them, frankly, from Madison, talks about going to the Madison Pride Parade, and that enabled her to be empowered enough to come out. So I understand the impulse, but it's not going to change. Sure. The question was about religious communities and same-sex arrangements, and also about did I uncover trans information. In the period in this book, there's no even word structure for trans individuals. There is a case of an individual in Milwaukee who was arrested, who had masqueraded for over a decade as a man, even though she was a woman. And she actually had married another woman as a man. Mm-hmm. And then, unfortunately, she had an affair with another woman, and that caused her wife to rat her out to the police, which got her into court. So, you know, there was another individual in Waupun who was very feminine in presentation, was known as Lipstick Bill. That may have been an early indication of a trans person, but again, the language vocabulary simply wasn't there for people to talk about it as identity or gender choice back then. Regarding religious communities, there's lots of indications of same-sex emotional attachments. Some monasteries had a special dormitory for what was termed the Warm Brothers. There is a St. Aelred from Riverloo Abbey in England who talks a lot about the love between brothers in the monastery. And there's some indications perhaps of lesbianism in some of the female communities as well. Clearly, if you didn't want to get married, going to a religious community was an option for you to avoid that other heteronormative kind of expectation. The reason for we're out of sync is in part due to Rodney Scheel, bless his memory. Rodney was the owner of the Hotel Washington, and before that, the Back Door, the first gay bar that was owned by gays in Madison. And Rodney started a picnic for the patrons of the Back Door, which he held sometime during the summer. And Rodney also was very tied in with the Milwaukee and Chicago gay communities. And Rodney would take busloads of gay men down to Chicago for their gay pride. So Chicago was the regional metropolis. Their gay pride became a focus for folks from the area. And so since you had busloads going to Chicago, you couldn't quite do the celebration here in Madison. So the Magic Picnic, which occurred later in summer, became the focus for Madison Pride events. And it's always sort of been sometime else. So it has historic origins.
Thank you.
Sure. And for our closing words, may the love that gives to life its beauty, the reverence that gives to life its sacredness, and the purpose that gives to life its deep significance be strong within each of us and lead us into ever deepening relationships with all of life. And that is by George G. Brooks. At this time, we greet our neighbor. Thank you for coming. Please extend the hand of friendship to those around you. You can join us for conversation. There's also tie-dyeing in the backyard if you brought something to tie-dye in anticipation for Pride in August. And thank you again for coming.
Thank you.